given a ride deep to right field, and that ball's way out of here. Nolan Gorman, home run number 7 on the season. 7 home runs in his last 7 games.
Slider back into his wind. Here she comes. Swing and a miss. He struck him out from the stretch. Swing and a miss. 1-2 on the way. Got him swinging. Check, swing and a miss. He
swing and
it.
A miss. Strike. Letter comes home.
Called strike 3.
Swing and a miss. Strike 3.
And 3 more strikeouts in the third for Jack Leiter. 7 Ks on the night.
And a breaking ball. Swung on. There it goes. Deep to right. Way back. Way out of here. That's a home run. O'Neill Cruz with a line drive. Home run to right field. And he wins the game for the Indians. It's a 2-run home run. What a way to end it.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another edition of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. It is draft season for us. Our top draft prospects list has expanded from 100 to 150, and we're going to dig into that today, break it down, look at some of the highest risers on the list, some players who have jumped onto the list, and some of the guys who have taken a bit of a tumble. One player who has certainly not taken a tumble and has remained securely at the top of the list, Cal Poly shortstop Brooks Lee, had a chance to chat with him. Jim and Jonathan did. We're going to listen in on that. And we are going to then turn our attention to the minor leagues and look at some of the prospects who are off to hot starts to this 2022 season. And we will wrap up by answering a question from the mailbag. The draft is, well, we're within 3 months now. Our list has expanded from 100 to 150. We'll expand it again from 150 to 200. I just think this is such a fun list, and I know I've said that when we talked about it before, but the names at the very top, to me, this is one of the more exciting lists, these high school hitters. And it's also just a weird list now because, you know, Jim, you have a story up now to go along with the list saying that the top of this draft could be unprecedented. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, normally there's a decent amount of balance in the draft, but, you know, I don't remember if I used this quote in the story, and I think I did, about, you know, when in doubt, you know, teams, you know, tend to default to college pitchers. You never have enough pitching. The college guys you feel are less risky than the high school guys because they're 3 years older, and hopefully you have a feel on health, and you've seen them against better competition. But I do think there's a good chance that at least the first 10 picks and maybe more could all be position players this year, which has never happened going back in draft history to 1965. And, you know, I mean, it only takes one, but I, you know, as if the draft were today, I'm not sure we'd see a college pitcher in the first 15 selections. And that hasn't happened since 1969. And back then the rules were much different. So many of the top college prospects wound up getting diverted to January drafts, or there was also a June secondary phase. So it wasn't really resembling what we have today where everybody's in one draft pool. And, you know, Jonathan, I know you've talked to a million people about this too. I mean, everybody's talking about, you know, we even chatted about it on the podcast last week. The number of pitchers, you know, who are hurt is staggering. There's at least 6 college pitchers who had a chance to go in the first round who have injury questions. Only one of them, Blade Tidwell, is actually even pitching right now. That doesn't count Kumar Rocker, who hasn't pitched since the Mets didn't like his post-draft physical and walked away from it. It doesn't count East Carolina's Carson Wisenhunt, who's not hurt, but is suspended for the entire year after testing positive for performance-enhancing drug. And, you know, Dylan Lesko, who we've talked about on the podcast, is the top high school pitcher. He hasn't pitched in about 3 weeks because of a sore arm. And you have 2 other guys who at least had, you know, some first round buzz in Noah Schultz and Cole Phillips. And Noah Schultz has mononucleosis and he might not pitch more than 2 innings all spring. And Cole Phillips had Tommy John surgery a few weeks after he hit 100 miles an hour. And I mean, nobody can remember a draft with that many potential first round arms with health questions. It's really, really crazy.
And it wasn't a great class to begin with on the college pitching front anyway, right? So we're talking about not a deep pool that has been thinned out even more because of that. And then the high schools, you know, you mentioned the high schoolers, and we're all kind of waiting to see what the deal is with Dylan Lesko. He's still on our top 10. We'll dig into, you know, the top list in a minute. But you know, and then the next two guys are guys from cold weather states. You know, you've got Brock Porter in Michigan and Andrew Dukanich in Indiana. So they're being seen now. You know, so I've never seen anything like this in terms of the disparity between hitters and pitchers, for sure.
So let's focus on the top of this list. Not a whole lot of change to the top 10. Number one is still Drew Jones. Two and three have flip-flopped: Elijah Green and Tamar Johnson. Green now number two and Johnson three, whereas it was the other way around back in December. But the biggest change is here at the number four spot, where Jackson Holliday has skyrocketed from his original spot of 51 to number four now. This is, of course, or maybe I shouldn't say of course, but this is the son of longtime big league star Matt Holliday. How did this happen? Why the big jump?
You know, it's interesting because last summer, you know, Jackson struggled on the showcase circuit a little bit. He got a little too home run crazy. Did finish well, but like, yeah, you know, we were working on the list in the offseason. I have Oklahoma, and I was talking to guys. You know, the consensus was, okay, you know, interesting guy, you know, projectable body. You know, his dad, obviously, Matt, grew to be a pretty big guy. But, you know, people were a little disappointed in the showcase performance. And he's been a different guy this spring. He has, you know, he's gotten bigger and stronger. He's firmed up his body. I think I commented to you guys on Slack when we were updating our old reports, as well as adding new reports to do the top 150. I think I upgraded him across the board. I don't remember ever doing that too often with guys. I mean, sometimes guys hit better or show more power, run a little quicker. But we actually, I think I bumped him up at least 5 and 10 points in some cases in every category. He's, you know, he's looking much better at the plate. He's not trying to hit home runs. He's looking more relaxed. His left-handed swing, you know, got long last summer. It's not doing that now. And he's just, it seems like he's barreling the ball. It's jumping off his bat even more. He's gotten quicker. His arm's gotten better. You feel like, you know, where maybe it was kind of borderline, maybe he's got a chance to stay at short, to now, oh, you know, he's got a real chance to stay at shortstop. You know, he's got the requisite high baseball IQ from growing up around the game. But it's been pretty impressive. I don't feel like, sometimes a guy slips through the cracks or you feel like you don't have good information on him. You look back, you're like, oh, I was light. Like, we talked to a lot of people, or I guess I did because it's Oklahoma, about Jackson Holliday coming into the year. So I felt like we had him kind of ranked appropriately based on teams we talked to. And then it's funny because he just got off to such a great start this spring. And until we update, I was like, man, I hate having Jackson Holliday at 51 on our list. It just makes our list look so old. And I don't think he's – I think he's going to go in the top 5 or 10 picks now. If he doesn't, I mean, it'd be kind of a cool story because his dad is a volunteer assistant at Oklahoma State, where his uncle Josh is the head coach. But I don't think we're going to have the family all reunited there. I don't think that's actually going to happen.
No, it doesn't seem like it. I will say that, and Jim obviously talked to more people, but when we put these lists together, then we try to get feedback from sort of national level scouting directors, executives, cross checkers. And I remember, you know, we got a decent amount of feedback about Holliday. Not that he should be up higher, but I had more than one person say, that's probably about where you should put him because of the summer he had, but kind of put a circle around him because he's the guy who is the most likely to make a jump come the spring. Because as much as he sort of got a little lost and got a little home run happy, there were enough believers in what he was able to do and that feel for the game that Jim mentioned that he would kind of readjust and get back to being who he was once he got into his regular high school season, kind of hit the reset switch. And it's been fun to see that that's exactly what he's done.
All right. So I mentioned that Elijah Green has jumped Tamar Johnson. And we were talking about this a little bit before the podcast, and I framed it just like that, that he jumped him. And Jim, you said more like gently nudged aside.
Yeah. I don't think Jonathan could talk about Elijah, but you know, in Tamar's case, it's not that he's had a bad spring. It's just been a tough look this spring. And people kind of knew this was going to be the case, but he doesn't play on a, very good team, and it's not a very good league. And you know, scouting directors going to see him. Like I heard one story where guys went in for doubleheader because you could get a lot, you know, hopefully get a lot of at bats with him. And his team got, I think, run ruled 20-0 and 15-0, and you got two at bats in two games. So I think Termaer is not that you can really judge him against the level of competition, but Termaer still is the best pure high school hitter guys have seen in quite a while. But if you go in to see him this spring to kind of be like, okay, I'm going to get excited again, it has been a tough look.
Yeah. And for Elijah Green, I mean, even when we, you know, wrote, or when I wrote him up in December and he was behind Termaer Johnson, you know, and we talked about the fact that he probably has the highest ceiling of anyone, or at least as high, if you want to put him in the same conversation with Drew Jones. But there were question marks. You know, there's always been some swing and miss to his game. Over the summer, he got exposed at times, especially to soft stuff. He chased too much, things like that. So the tools are ridiculous. He's unbelievably athletic. He's big. He's strong, raw power. He can run. He can throw. He can do everything. But was he going to hit enough? And you know, this spring he's at IMG Academy, so he has the benefit of facing good competition, and has really done a lot of work with his approach at the plate, where he is not swinging and missing as much. I think he's always going to be a guy who's going to have some strikeouts to his game, but I don't know that people care about that. It was more, you know, is he going to have trouble recognizing breaking stuff at the next level? And because he's seen some good secondary stuff and has been doing a much better job of recognizing, you know, not chasing stuff out of the zone, it's allowed him to hit better, get to his power in games, things of that nature. He's kind of been on fire all spring, and there hasn't, you know, there's been no lull. He's just kind of kept it going. And so that's why he's, you know, we kind of made the decide to put him at two and Termaer at three. But there's not a ton separating them, in my opinion.
Big, strong, fast, five tools. I know you guys don't like to do comps, but are you getting a lot of young Jason Ratliff comps with Green?
That's the one that comes up the most, yeah.
Not quite as fast. Like young Jason Ratliff, but not quite as fast.
Steps lower.
A touch more power, not as fast, yeah.
That makes sense. That also reminds me, I guess I was just kind of assuming everyone knows who we are. I didn't introduce us.
Oops.
Jim Callis, Jonathan Mayo, and I'm Jason Ratliff. Maybe we should have done that at the top of the show. All right. Well, before we want to talk about the highest risers on the list. But before we do that, I want you guys to talk about one more guy in the top 10 who took a pretty big jump. Doesn't make our list of guys who made the biggest jumps on the list. But within the top 10, outside of Holiday, Daniel Suzak, who went from 23 on the preseason, or well, I shouldn't say preseason, the original top 100 list, into the top 10 here.
Yeah, Arizona's my neck of the woods again. Another family connection. His brother Andrew caught in the big leagues, and you know, he's really hit even better than last year. He's a draft eligible sophomore, so he took another step forward with the bat. I think he's been more consistent. That way he's big and strong. You know, there were some questions about his abilities behind the plate. People are comfortable enough that he can catch. It's been kind of interesting because when we first started sending the list out for feedback and we ran him up pretty high. And I think this speaks to what we were saying before about, you know, a lot of the pitching has gone by the wayside, and, you know, started out thinking, I don't know that he really is a top 10 guy, even though the numbers are good. He was a really good college performer, but felt more like a 15-20 kind of guy. And I had someone who we get feedback from ask me, like, I know it's early, but like, are you hearing his name up that high? And initially my response was, well, not yet. I mean, we haven't really dug in like that, but someone's got to be in the top 10. And, you know, he's performed to belong there. Postscript is I'm working on our first mock draft, and I'm hearing a lot of Daniel Suzak going in the top 10, 11, 12 picks. So, you know, it's sort of like the performance has caught up to where I think he's going to go. And, you know, he's a big, strong guy who most people think will catch. And let's say for whatever reason he can't, he's going to hit, and he's going to hit with power.
Okay, so now let's talk about the highest risers. Let's break it down into two distinct categories here. Guys who are new to the list, were not on the top 100 at all. And then we'll talk about guys who were on the top 100 and made big jumps up in the top 150. Let's start with that first group. And Jonathan, who do you have?
Bryson Mautz from the University of San Diego jumped up to 63 after not being on the top 100. And I think there's a whole kind of group, and they're sprinkled throughout the top 150, but I think there are a bunch of college arms who move up by default because they're performing and they're healthy. Now, obviously, scouts aren't just looking at a box score and that they're taking the ball every week. You know, he's a 6'3" left-hander. You know, the other thing, you know, the reason why he wasn't on the list and is now is he had mostly been a reliever, moved into the rotation this spring, has been San Diego's Saturday starter, and he's been very, very effective. He's always missed bats, but he hasn't always thrown strikes, and his command has improved. He's filling up the strike zone. He's cut his walk rate, by more than half. He's got a funky delivery. It's deceptive, kind of, lower three-quarter arm slot that makes some people nervous. But right now, he's throwing three pitches for strikes. The fastball is in the low 90s as a starter, but people don't see it because of the funky delivery. It's got sink and life to it. So he gets ground ball outs. The slider tunnels off of the fastball. So even though it's a good pitch, it's they're not picking it up. And the changeup, he's just starting to throw more now, because when he was in a bullpen role, he wasn't throwing it. So he's kind of interesting. I think he's the kind of guy that you send out as a starter and see if it holds up over the course of a long season, because maybe you have a kind of an interesting, funky left-handed starter, but also know that the fastball ticks up. He was up to 96, 97 out of the bullpen. He could be a really good left-handed reliever if starting doesn't work.
All right, Jim, who's someone from your neck of the draft who made a big jump onto the list?
Well, the biggest jump, and I touched on him earlier, was Cole Phillips, the high school pitcher from Texas, who jumped up to number 50, but has had Tommy John surgery. He might have been a borderline first rounder if not for the Tommy John. But the guy I wanted to talk about was the second biggest jump, who was Thomas Harrington, who's now number 53 on the list after not being ranked. You know, it's funny. His name came up. He could have made the top 100. We left him off. Now he's number 53, and he's interesting. He was a walk-on who was the Big South Conference freshman of the year last year at Campbell. In his last outing, he one-hit Mississippi State, which went on to win national championship for five innings in NCAA regionals. And he's got one of the better combinations of stuff and strikes. And as we've talked about, there aren't that many healthy college pitchers. He's among the NCAA Division I leaders in a number of categories. He has a chance to pass Seth Johnson, who the Rays took 40th overall back in 2019, his highest pick in school history. And, he's got, his fastball velocity will fluctuate a little bit. He can be 90-93 on some days, 93-96 on his best days. But even on the days at lesser velocity, he misses a lot of bats because he's got good arm side run and carry on the fastball. He's got a mid-80s changeup. A mid-80s changeup with tumble, which I guess I was about to call chumble, that he can get swings and misses into the strike zone. He can get you to chase it out of the strike zone. He can flash a plus slider. He can mix in a curveball like as a different look. Really good athlete who repeats his delivery well and just throws a ton of strikes. Draft eligible sophomore. He'll be 21 a week before the draft. A lot of upside. And, as Jonathan was saying too, there are going to have to be some college pitchers who go in the first round. And I think Harrington's a guy who could sneak into the first round. I think Mautz is a guy who could sneak into the first round. Some of these guys are going to have to work their way into the first round from the college pitching crop.
I love the chumble.
Chumble, that's a new one. Where I chumble 60.
Trademark that.
Imagine if imagine if John Duran picked that up and he could have a splinker and a chumble.
Yep. So I don't know if you have the fading change up. Maybe that's the chade. The chade and the chumble. Those are two new pitches now.
I like chumble. I would rank chumble ahead of chade.
Yeah, but then you could write that he's throwing chade. Like, and
no,
he's disrespecting the hitters by throwing shade. So
that's pretty good.
Splinker Chumple Shade. All right. Let's talk about some guys who were already on the list previously, but are much higher now. Jonathan.
Yeah, for me, the guy who's made the biggest jump up has been Gabe Hughes at Gonzaga University. Again, college pitcher, healthy, but boy, he has really, really performed and gone from a guy who was sort of interesting to a guy who, for me, is definitely going to go at some point in the first round. I mean, he's at number 19 right now, and I could see him going somewhere in that neck of the woods, because it's just every week he goes out and does it. He's been Gonzaga's Friday night starter. So it'd be the first Gonzaga first round selection since who? Pop quiz.
Marco Gonzalez?
Yes. And like Marco Gonzalez, Gabe Hughes was a two-way guy. Not as good, and now he's pitching only. Marco Gonzalez, if I recall correctly, was a two-time John Olerud winner. I'm not 100% that I'm doing without looking. At any rate, I mean, he's 6'4". The stuff is really, really good. The fastball's up to 97 regularly. He might throw harder, throws a really good slider that flashes plus and can touch 90 miles an hour. And he's got good feel for his changeup. It's electric stuff, and he throws strikes with them. Uses both sides of the plate, commands the soft stuff, really good makeup. He's sort of, he doesn't have the command of George Kirby, but Kirby didn't throw this hard back in college, but it's sort of the guy who goes in middle of the late back end of the first round who might end up being much, much better than people realize. Although I think people are starting to realize. I mean, they knew he was good. He pitched well for Team USA over the summer, but he's a guy I'm very excited about.
All right. And Jim, I think you're pretty excited about Gilly Goubert.
Yeah, Drew Gilbert. I just noticed his Twitter handle is Gilly Goubert, GILLYGOOBEAR. Also a two-way guy, although he's not pitching. He did not give up a run last year in 8 innings of relief. He could get the fastball up to 93. Guys actually do like him on the mound, but he's so good in center field, and Tennessee's pitching staff so deep, they have not used him on the mound. And a quick fact check, Marco Gonzalez won John Olerud Award. The only multi-time winner is Brendan McKay, who won 3. And unfortunately, the winners of the John Olerud Award have not had good pro careers. They've often been hurt, unfortunately. But anyway, back to Drew Gilbert. Tennessee's got a lot of guys playing well. They're the best team in the country. He's hitting around 350, more walks and strikeouts. You know, he's got ops over 1,100. And, you know, guys liked him coming into the year. They just wondered what his ceiling was exactly. He's 5'9", 185. He's not a big guy. He kind of plays with his hair on fire in all phases of the game, and he was really aggressive at the plate. So he had some hand-eye coordination, really good hand-eye coordination, where he could regularly get the barrel to the ball. But the swing would get long. He was probably too focused on home runs for a smaller guy. And people, you know, liked him but thought, okay, third rounder, you know, the approach is a little bit too aggressive. And he's toned it down slightly. He's doing a lot more damage, you know, a lot more consistent damage at the plate. You know, he's not going to be a slugger, but now that he's settled down a little bit, I think he's got a better chance to get to 15 and 20 homers without, you know, swinging for the fences. You know, solid to plus runner, but really good instincts on the bases. He's aggressive. He steals, he takes the extra base. Same thing in center field. It's not, you know, he's not like a 65 or 70 runner, but he covers a ton of ground because he's got really good instincts in center field. You know, I mentioned, you know, he's up to 93 on the mound. Good feel for curveball too. He actually, going back to our 2019 draft stuff, Jonathan, when he's from Minnesota, and he was the second best. He probably the second best stuff among all the pitchers in the upper Midwest behind Quinn Priester, who's now a top 100 guy for the Pirates. So he can really throw. People love the makeup, and, you know, I think just kind of settling down at the plate, not trying to do too much, has allowed him to have a better year, has allowed guys to believe that the approach is going to play at the next level. And I do think, you know, right now, I think he's probably hit his way into the, you know, bottom third of the first round. Guys like the tools, love the makeup, love the performance.
All right. So those are some of the highest risers on our new top 150 draft prospects list. And we don't want to focus too much on guys who have fallen, but let's take a look at a couple of guys who have fallen and talk about why. First, Jonathan A. Sprinkle has fallen.
Very nice. Yeah, Jordan Sprinkle from Santa Barbara, you know, trying to encapsulate the sort of collective disappointment the scouting industry has had. Because he had a really good sophomore year. And, you know, every year we talk about, especially at the college level, but I think across the board, when you have a guy who plays shortstop in the amateur, and there's all often that caveat of, well, they're not going to be able to stay there, or it's unclear. Jordan Sprinkle can no doubt play shortstop. He's a plus runner. He's super athletic. He has great instincts, good hands. He's got a really good arm. He's going to play shortstop for a very, very long time. And the reason why scouts were excited is it looked like he was going to hit too. You know, not a ton of power, but he had gotten stronger. There was extra base authority, made a ton of contact, and it kind of has all gone sideways this spring. He had really clicked with Santa Barbara's hitting coach last year and does not have the same bond with their new hitting coach. That's not an excuse, mind you, but I think it's impacted him, and he's been a little bit lost at the plate. He's making bad swing decisions. He's hitting under 300, but he can play shortstop, no doubt. So a team that thinks the guy they saw last year is for real and they can refine that, they'll take him pretty high. But he's gone from a guy who looked like a kind of no doubt about it late first round pick to a guy that has a lot of question marks about his offensive profile.
Well, you could say the same thing about Nolan McLean. There are a lot of questions about his offensive profile now too. And he's a guy, I really liked him back in the 2020 draft. And I think he could have gone the first three rounds coming out of North Carolina high school. He's a two-way guy, but he also wanted to play quarterback in college. Oklahoma State gave him the opportunity to see if that would work out. He didn't play for them his first season on campus, decided to focus on baseball. And coming into the year, you know, we had him as kind of that, you know, sandwich round, early second round area, but he was a pick of a lot of guys to click. Like, they thought he was going to take a step forward and, you know, really, you know, play his way in the first round. You know, he's got, you know, there are a few guys in this draft who I think can match his combination of raw power and arm strength and really fits the third base profile well. People were really excited about seeing him in the fall, and he's come out and he's pulled his average up a little bit, but he's striking out at about a 40% clip, which is not good. He's second in the nation in strikeouts. He does have 9 home runs, but you know, people are very concerned about the swing and miss tendencies, you know, obviously. Now, the interesting thing is, I do almost wonder if he might get drafted as a pitcher rather than as a third baseman. He has pitched some relief for Oklahoma State this year. He's got 28 strikeouts in 16 innings. He, you know, as I mentioned, the strong arm, the fastball's up to 98. He's got a pair of power breaking pitches in his slider and downer curveball that could be plus. You know, I think he's more reliever than starter. Although you can make the argument that, you know, he's been a two-way guy, he's been playing football, he's pretty athletic. If you focused on pitching, you know, maybe you have a starting pitcher in there. So, guys, you know, he's going to be a guy, you know, there's a lot of, you know, interesting draft guys on Oklahoma State who are hard to figure out, so they're going to be scouted pretty heavily. But, you know, if I could still see him going in the first, you know, three or four rounds of the draft, maybe higher if he heats up at the plate. But I don't, you know, I think it's like I said, if you told me he got drafted and he was announced as a right-handed pitcher, it wouldn't surprise me, because he's been, even though it's been a smaller sample size as a reliever, he's been much more dominant in that role than he has as a hitter.
I think one of the things, there's a smattering of guys like this who, you know, do we know, Jim, does Don McLean want to hit at the next level? Because it's sometimes what happens is a kid, you know, wants to try to hit. And so even if you hear him announced as a third baseman, he may be given the chance to hit. And then when that doesn't work, the team that took him knows that they can that put him on the mound. So it'll be curious to see what happens there.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't know if he stayed that. I mean, I know out of high school, everybody felt like his greatest desire was to try to play quarterback in college. And so that's why, you know, and the other thing with him that might make it difficult to get him this year is he's only in his second year at Oklahoma State. He's a true sophomore, age eligible, and maybe he'll decide to go back and try for a better year.
McLean has fallen to number 140 on the top 150 draft prospects list after being number 46 on our early top 100 list. And Jordan Sprinkle, who Jonathan talked about, has fallen from 29 to 101. Let's take a break and then come back and talk to someone who has not fallen at all, has remained anchored at the very top, and that is Cal Poly shortstop Brooks Lee. We're going to talk to him when we come back after this break on the MLB Pipeline podcast.
Pleased to have a great guest on the Pipeline podcast this week. Actually, our top-ranked college prospect in the 2022 draft, our draft top 150, has just come out, and that's Brooks Lee from Cal Poly. Brooks, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
So I'll ask you the first question. You've been through the draft process before, and even though you didn't go high in the draft, you could have had you wanted to go pro out of high school. I mean, I know you had, you know, first-round offers, the offers of first-round money. Obviously, your situation's a little bit different than most, considering who your college coach is. But what was that decision-making process like the first time for you?
It was actually pretty stressful. So, you know, making a decision at 18 years old, changing your life, and having that opportunity to go play for your dad, it's a lot of things to juggle at one time. So I ended up making the decision the day before the draft on Sunday. And it was just a family decision and stuck with it. And now here we are.
You know, it's the obvious question to sort of ask about the playing for your dad as someone who coached his own son, you know, up to a certain point. I can't even imagine that relationship at that level. You know, how did the two of you kind of keep that balanced? I mean, do you have to catch yourself and not call him dad when you're on the field, or has it just been going on for so long that you're kind of used to it?
I started calling him Coach Lee probably senior year of high school. So I stuck with it even when I'm not around him or I'm at home too. I call him Coach Lee. So I do it, and he's we're not the same people. So it's easier to get along, I feel like. So I'm a little bit different than he is, and we fit perfectly for each other.
So I got to follow up with that one. So after you go into pro ball, does he become dad again, or will he still be Coach Lee?
It'll probably still be Coach Lee. So, cause I'm sure he'll be, giving me some, constructive feedback, probably not in the best way sometimes. So, it'll be Coach Lee.
It's not just your dad. I mean, this is like the family business. You know, talk a little bit about what it was like growing up with various members of your family, uncles who played pro ball, things like that. It just, it sounds like it's kind of like a family heirloom that was handed down to you at an early age.
Yeah, it's probably the best situation you could have as a kid who wants to play professional baseball. So I had my dad's two brothers play professional baseball, and their dad, who was in a plethora of other things in professional sports. So not to mention Cal Poly has been the legacy that we've had for so many years. So there's a bunch of different reasons why I am who I am, and especially because of the family background that I have.
Pena, we write all the time. I know I write all the time. Jonathan writes it all the time. We're writing up reports on players. You know, so-and-so grew up around the game, and he's got a high baseball IQ, and his instincts are off the charts. But, like, I guess in a way, maybe that is a cliche, but in a way, I almost feel like it's also very true. Like it just seems like people who grew up around the game, you know, whether their dad's a college coach or their dad was a big leaguer, have just been exposed to so many aspects of baseball that – it is an advantage. How much has that helped you?
Oh, a lot. I think that it's probably taught me more how to win than anything else, versus being the flat out prospect, with all the tools. So, I think that being that ball player that I am, comes first, and I feel like I'm pretty old school in the way that I think, as a player, and I try and be my own coach on the field. So, I think I mean, it's helped me in a bunch of different ways, but probably learn how to win is the most important one, of being instinctual and having those characteristics of like an old school ball player.
You mentioned being instinctual, because I would imagine that there's got to be a balance there, right? You don't want to be inside your head too much, right? I think someone who has those, all those lessons that you've learned and coach on the field, which I've heard you've been, any scout I ever talked to, and Jim and I split up the country, and I'm lucky enough that you're in my half of the country. So that's what everyone brings up. Do you have to remind yourself sometimes just to go out and play and not try to sort of micromanage yourself?
Yeah, that's why I can't stay in the off season, because I just want to play. So I'm always trying to think about different ways to improve my swing or mechanics for any other part of the game. But I definitely need to catch myself sometimes, like in the fall, I'm just here to hit the baseball right now and have fun. We're taking BP, and I don't need to be so adjusting in what I do. So it's tough, but honestly, it's a good problem to have, to know all that information and then be able to cut it down when I need to.
You can make a decision to go play for your dad at Cal Poly, and yet your career could not have begun like you envisioned it. I mean, you had a pretty serious injury. It was it in fall ball, I guess, your freshman year?
Yeah, got surgery on Halloween of 2019.
And from what I remember, it was a knee injury and a hamstring injury. You just hit the base funny, like running out of a ball at first base?
I hit a ground ball to second, and about 3 or 4 steps down the line, hyperextended my knee. And so it perfectly tore my LCL, which is on the outside of your knee, and then the biceps femoris, which is the third part of your hamstring. So I'm a pretty good kinesiology major without being in school.
And how hard was it to come back from that? I mean, that's a pretty major injury. I mean, was it, I know it's a pretty rare injury. Were you worried about it being career threatening at all at the time?
At the time, yeah. So I know like my surgeon had only done 3 or 4 of those, and he's the head surgeon for the Rams. So it was pretty threatening for my career, I thought, at the time. And then once the process started with rehab, I got a really good physical therapist in San Luis Obispo, and then everything kind of set sail from there. But it wasn't easy at all. But I'm actually thankful that I got to do it. I got to change the way my body works, my body type. I got a lot stronger and faster because of it. And I think it's more of a blessing in disguise than anything.
I think, we've waited long enough to talk hitting, right? I think we have to. We have Brooks Lee. He's the best college hitter in baseball. I think we have to talk hitting. Tell us a little bit just, about how your approach has evolved. Obviously, it's incredibly advanced. You hit over 400 on the Cape. You've kept hitting this spring. Your bat-to-ball skills, people talk about all the time. Like, sort of break down what you try to do in the box in any given at bat.
It's complicated because I have a different approach for almost every type of pitcher, from the left and the right side. And there's so many different aspects that go into it once I go up to the plate. So, field, wind, how I feel on that day, who's throwing, what the defense is like. I mean, there's a bunch of different things, but, traditionally I try and go the other way, just like everybody else. So if I'm left-handed, I'll go to left center, and I want to be on time for a fastball left center. And then if I'm a little bit early on an off-speed pitch, I'll pull it probably down the right field line or to right field. But if I'm perfectly on time for that off-speed pitch, I'll hit to the right center gap. So it's different. I like to have a flat swing. So I don't have anything to do with that launch angle or anything like that. So, I'm all about just getting hits and hitting the ball hard consistently. And then, once I get stronger, those doubles I hit will turn into home runs, and the singles will turn into doubles like that. So, but it's pretty complicated. And I can go on for hours talking about hitting.
We don't mind.
Yeah, just like my dad. So no matter what, though, I try and keep it pretty simple once I get in the box. And after every single pitch, I'll learn something about what I feel or what that pitcher has to offer. And then I'll go from there and compete.
Well, Jim, he answered like every single one of my follow-up questions just in his one answer. So, I don't have much. I mean, I guess the quick follow-up I'll ask, because you sort of touched on it, I guess the one thing that people ask is about, how much power will there be at the next level? And you kind of touched on it. Do you chuckle when you hear that? You're like, I could hit the power if I wanted to.
Yeah, it's a little different. Like where we play, I get rewarded with doubles because we have big gaps and it's a big field. But hitting 10 home runs last year is a lot for Baggett Stadium, which is where we play at. So I always felt that it'd be a little bit different where I played. But I mean, it doesn't matter. It's all the same playing field once you really get up there.
Yeah, and Brooks did hit, I think, 6 home runs in 21 games on the Cape last year with wood bats. So, I mean, you showed some power against, you know, wood bats against good competition. How long have you been switch hitting? How did that start? Do you feel better from one side or the other? Or, you know, a lot of guys will say they're better left-handed just because they get more at-bats left-handed. But how did that all start?
So I had no choice growing up. So that's another thing in the family business is everybody switch hits. So, I mean, I have wanted to switch hit my whole life and I've stuck with it and it's tough. But I really think that I'm the same from both sides. I just, once again, get more left-handed at bats. So it's that experience level that I think has drawn me further along on the left side. But that's why, like, going to college in the fall, it was one of the things that we were going to work on. My dad and I was, all right, we're going to try and get my right-handed swing up to par with my left-handed. And be that same comfort level. So I always face left-handed pitching and inner squads and scrimmages. And so no matter how bad I did, I knew that it was going to help me in the long run. And so far, I've had a better year right-handed than I did last year. So it's coming along a little bit.
All right, let me ask you about your defense, because I think that's the other thing that people come up. You're playing shortstop right now. I've noticed a little bit of shift when I've talked to scouts who I think – if asking them in the fall gave you maybe an infinitesimal percentage of playing shortstop at the next level. And I think you've proven to some people that maybe you can stay there. Is that something that you even care about? Like if you get drafted and the team that drafts you says, we want you to play third, you'll be all in, or do you want to go out and prove to people that you actually could stick it short?
Yeah. I mean, I want to prove people. So, like, I know the statistics about Brandon Crawford's 60 time, Corey Seager's down to first, all those things. So I know I'm right up there with the rest of them. But the thing that separates me, I think, would be those instincts and knowing where to position myself. So I know I have a good internal clock because growing up, I didn't have the best arm. So I really had to use my feet and make sure I got the ball one or two steps in front of the runner. I would like to prove myself to people that you know, somebody that doesn't have the greatest feet or foot speed in the world can play short. And we see that in the big leagues right now. So, when it comes down to it, any team that wants me to play third base and that's what's going to help us win the game, then that's what I'll do. So I just want to be most successful wherever I play. And if they happen to like me at third base or second base or wherever, I'll be happy to do that if it means we're going to win more baseball games.
Brooks, I always like to ask players their impressions of other players, like make you be a little bit of a scout. But, like, you've played with and against a lot of good players. You're on Team USA and played in the Cape last year, your college career. Who is the best position player you've seen and the best pitcher you've seen since you've gotten to college?
I would say all around, Dylan Cruz, when I played with him in Team USA. I think that he had, like, extreme bat speed, and he knew exactly what he wanted to do. He could manipulate the bat to do anything he wanted with any pitch in the game. So I think that him being a year younger than us also showed us a lot of, we're all like, all right, Dylan, good thing you're not in our draft class. I'd say him. And then I really face a lot of good pitchers. You had Reggie Crawford, who's a flamethrower. And then I thought Gabriel Hughes was especially good at Gonzaga. I think I faced him 4 or 5 times, and every time I ground out to second. So that wasn't a good feeling. But, yeah, he's definitely an all-around good pitcher and has the stuff and the body for it. And then our guy here, Drew Thorpe, was on Team USA in the Cape with us. So, I've faced him a lot more than anybody else has. And it's pretty even, but I know that he dominates everybody else. So I have a little bit of an advantage playing against him. I'm playing behind him all the time.
I was actually going to ask you about Drew Thorpe because, you know, scouts have the ability, like, well, they're going to go see you. Then they can watch him. And he's had a good spring in a year where college pitchers have been getting hurt a lot. Performance have been up and down. So, I mean, just the fact that he takes the ball every week is a step forward, but he's been really good. What makes him so successful?
He started out like the thing that separated him his freshman and sophomore year is the changeup. So we call it the equalizer, and it mimics the fastball perfectly until about 10 or 15 feet from the plate. So it's extremely hard to hit for that reason. And then he developed, what we think is a big league slider, and it's been working. So, and we always, we throw like fastballs outside, fastballs inside, fastballs up in the zone. And I think he's probably had the best command out of all of our pitching staff since day one, since he got on campus. So obviously the physical talent has been separating him, but I think the mental game that he has and that fierce competitor that he is really changes who he is. And, he has a chance to be a really good professional baseball player. And we're seeing it right before our eyes.
Well, I mean, I think he's got a chance to possibly go in the first round as well in July. And I know obviously the focus is, working on, trying to win the Big West title, get into NCAA regionals and go from there. How much time you spend thinking on the draft, or how much, draft chatter do you hear? I don't think we're quite in mock draft season yet, but it's coming soon. I mean, do you try to tune that stuff out? I mean, can you?
I always just think that, hey, it's just, it's a good thing that I'm in this situation right now. So, I hear it every day, whether I want to hear it or not, it's just something that will pop up on my phone or things I get tagged in. So I have no problem with it. And, I'm not that person that needs to exit out to play good. So, I want to enjoy the time that I have with my dad right now. And then we all know that, a couple months down the line, that's when, things will start changing. So, but for right now, I'm focused on playing baseball, and but it'll always be there, whether I want it to or not.
Well, I'm doing our first mock in a few days. Where do you want to go?
I think you know where I want to go. Yeah. You might be spot on. We'll see.
Yeah. We'll find being spot on in that first mock draft is throwing darts. It's a little early, but we'll follow up with you later and we'll see if we can sync up.
Yeah.
Well, thanks a lot, Brooks. We really appreciated talking to you today. I know I was thinking in the back of my mind when you were breaking down some of those players for us, Jonathan and I, we the draft top 150 has just come out. You're our top ranked college player, number 5, but we have 100 more reports that we have to write by the time we get the draft top 250 done. And I feel like, I don't know, Jonathan, we should Brooks can knock off a couple of those for us based on.
Yeah. We'll give them all the hitters.
Yeah. Well, I used to be recruiting at area codes and all those tryouts and stuff as a kid. So, I've got it down.
There you go. Well, we'll definitely, if you want to write some scouting reports for us, we'll definitely let you do that because there are never any. But Brooks, we really appreciate it. Good luck the rest of the way. Good luck in the draft. Enjoy the time. It sounds like it's a pretty cool deal playing with your dad, and look forward to seeing where you go near the top of the draft in July.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Thanks, Brooks. Well, that was great talking to Brooks Lee. Great hitter, great talker, great evaluator of talent. Really enjoyed that. And we'll be back in a moment with more on the MLB Pipeline Podcast.
Welcome back to the MLB Pipeline Podcast. I'm Jason Ratliff here with Jim Callis and Jonathan Mayo, and we're going to talk about some hitters who are off to fast starts in the minor leagues, and then we're going to answer a question in the mailbag to wrap things up. But I also wanted to let people know, if you don't know already, that we've started something new, which is pretty exciting. Just over the past weekend, for the first time, we streamed a minor league game on MLB.tv. So what that means is, if you are one of the approximately zillion MLB.tv subscribers out there, you're able to watch select minor league games throughout the rest of the season. Our first one was a tasty little pitching matchup up until shortly before the game. was supposed to be Asa Lacy versus Jack Leiter, AA Northwest Arkansas and AA Frisco. And Lacy was scratched shortly before the game with what they said on the broadcast, some back troubles. And but we got to watch Leiter, which was fun, especially for the first inning. He looked completely dominant, striking out the side. Ran into a little trouble, which was exacerbated or caused by an error. All of his runs unearned in that game, but always fun to watch Jack Leiter. And we're going to continue to select some fun games for you to watch. We've got a couple more on tap this week, depending on when you're listening to this podcast. We have games on Wednesday and Thursday. Wednesday, Buffalo at Worcester with two of the game's top 20 prospects facing off with Gabriel Marino and Tristan Casas. And then on Thursday, this is extra special. In addition to being streamed on MLB.tv, this is going to be our very first pipeline game of the month, where Jim, Jonathan, and Sam Dykstra will be taking turns visiting minor league clubs and joining the broadcasts with those clubs. Sam is headed to Somerset, where we have a Yankees-Red Sox matchup, and Anthony Volpe being the focal point there, and actually his 21st birthday, so well-timed.
Sam's going to take him out for drinks, right?
they are definitely rolling out the red carpet for Sam at Somerset, and he's going to be doing a lot of different stuff there. I don't know if that's part of it. I don't know if they've arranged.
I mean, he could legally could drink during the game even. Like, that could be like add to the degree of difficulty or something. So who knows?
I don't know if he, I guess legally, I don't know. There may be rules against that.
He's 21. It'd probably be frowned upon. Probably frowned upon.
Yeah. It might impact his performance. Just saying.
Definitely keep an eye out on MLB.com/pipeline for further games throughout the season, but that's all very exciting. All right, let's talk about some exciting starts to the season. We are going to do a story. You guys are in the process of putting together your lists now of one hitter from each organization who is off to a fast start. Jim, a bush is on fire.
Very nice. It's a burning bush. But now Michael Busch of the Dodgers, I think, is showing why the Dodgers took him in the first round back in 2019. Not to read too much. I'm not saying he's going to have a, hit 321 with a 1234 ops and a 755 slugging percentage all year. But, he really hasn't had much of a chance at full strength since they took him in the first round. He got hit on the hand by pitch 10 games into his pro debut in 2019. So that ended his season there. He came back and played a little bit in the fall league at the end of 2019. You had the pandemic in 2020. And then they jumped him to AA to show how much they believed in his advanced offensive ability. They jumped him to AA, and he got hit on the hand again by pitch. And he was hampered early in the year. And then he kind of had a strong second half. But for a guy whose bat was his ticket to the first round, hitting 267 with 20 homers, it was a good first full season, but didn't blow you away. But he's healthy now. He really picked it up in the second half last year. And he's doing what Michael Busch did in college, which is hit for average, draw a ton of walks, and hit for power. And, the Dodgers, who, I've said this a million times, have a knack for making players into the best versions of themselves. With Busch, one of the questions when they took him was, okay, we know this guy's one of the better offensive performers in college baseball, but where realistically is he going to play? He had played some first base, mostly at North Carolina. He played some outfield. He had played some third base and second base in the Cape, but it was kind of uncertain. And for a guy who is listed at 6'1", 210 pounds, he does not have the speed of a young Jason Ratliff. It's kind of, below average to fringy speed. Second base seemed like a stretch, but he's gotten a little bit quicker. He's improved defensively. The profile is kind of similar to Max Muncy in that you can get by with this guy at second base. He plays at least adequately there, especially with the positioning. And he's another guy who, if he keeps hitting like this, the Dodgers not only develop guys, they seem to develop them pretty quickly. I don't think it's out of the question that he could be pushing, he'll go to AAA first, but he could be pushing for a role in Los Angeles by the end of the season because the bat is that advanced and that good.
That's a nice little lineup in Tulsa, isn't it?
I think virtually every member of that lineup is on our Dodgers top 30 list. It's a bunch of guys who are legit prospects.
Yeah, and so far, mostly performing quite well. Jonathan, I guess we're going to stick with a Los Angeles theme here.
Yeah, I'm really excited about how Jordan Adams has started out this year. Again, with the small sample size caveat, it's 10 games in. He's number 7 prospect now with the Angels. Really interesting guy. He was, you know, a multi-sport athlete in high school. Could have gone to play Division I college football, but opted to play baseball. It was a little bit of a surprise first rounder for the Angels in 2018. And then in 2019, kind of had a, I would say, better than expected first full season, just in terms of his feel and his approach at the plate. Got promoted to high A as a teenager. It all looked good. And then 2021, his approach kind of went completely backwards. Strikeout rate way too high. Didn't draw any walks or use his speed, you know, to the greatest advantage. And then he's back in high A this year. He's still only 22 for all of this year. So there's plenty of time for him to figure it out. But so far, so good. He's not striking out a ton. He's hit 378. He's got 5 extra base hits. 2 of those are triples. He's already stolen 5 bases, as they've been encouraging him to use his speed more. You know, I don't know how much power he's going to have, but I think he's going to impact the ball enough. And if this continues, right, if he's kind of rediscovered the approach that he showed in 2019, he has a chance to be a top of the order guy. He plays tremendous defense in center field, plus defender there. A few years before you have to worry about that. You know, that seems to keep happening with the Angels, but an interesting package of tools. And the question's always been, well, is he going to hit? And so far this year, he's making some good adjustments. So I have a feeling he'll get promoted to Double A at some point this year, and that'll be a really good test for him.
Okay, let's swing back to the draft. Mailbag question this week comes from Charles Brown, who asks, what do you do if you're the Orioles at number 1? College underslot or high-end high school? Who do you take?
Do you think if you're named Charles Brown, you make sure you go by Charles at all time?
Well, there was the NFL wide receiver who went by Charlie Brown, right?
Sure.
Redskin, right?
I believe so.
Back when they were the Redskins?
Anyway, so I think, I mean, if I'm picking, I'm taking the best player available. And so right now that probably would be Drew Jones. And, you know, no idea what signability or anything like that is. And if I'm looking, you know, what the Orioles are doing, again, teasing, we'll have our first mock draft this week, way too early. But they are heavily scouting the top 4 high school hitters that we talked about early. So Drew Jones and, you know, Elijah Green, Tamar Johnson, and Jackson Holliday are all, you know, in their mix. And there's a couple of college hitters. Right now, it looks like Brooks Lee and Jacob Berry from LSU. And, you know, you look at what the Orioles have done the last couple of years, which has been to save money on a college hitter with their first pick, which has been early. Not in the top spot. You know, when they had the top spot, they took Adley Rutschman, and he was also the best player on the board who happened to be a college player. So it remains to be seen what they do with that. There is the potential that they could go that route. But I don't, you know, I'm not sure this year. Like I could see them taking a high school hitter. Jim, what, you know, what do you think is in a way too early projection as to what the Orioles might do?
Yeah, you know, it's risky when you start playing games with your first round pick, because in the last 2 drafts, as you mentioned, Jonathan, you know, they took a below slot guy to save the money for later. And 2 years in a row, the guy they wanted did not get to them, which is always a risk. You can't guarantee that the target that you want, which 2 years ago was Nick Bitzko and last year was Judd Fabian, is going to fall, you know, 20 or more picks to be available with your next selection. So, you know, I have a hard time reading what they're going to, I mean, and as you said, it's way early. We're almost 3 months out. I think it's too early to really have a read on what they're going to do, because you can look back to last time that they had the number one pick and you could say they took a college guy, which was Rutschman, or you could say they took the best player on the board, which was Rutschman, which could lead you either way. You know, right now, if I had to guess, I would say Brooks Lee. If I had to guess what I thought they were going to do, and not just because we enjoy talking to Brooks on this podcast, if it were me, who would I take? I would never, when I'm picking the number one pick, play games with the pick. I would identify the guy I think is the best player in the draft and take him. So I would take Drew Jones at number one.
All right. So you guys, you agree. You do the same thing. You both take Drew Jones. Is that's an accurate summation?
Yep. That is an accurate summation.
Make it happen.
There's your answer, Charles Brown. All right. Thanks very much to Charles for his question. Thanks very much to Brooks Lee for joining us on the podcast today. That's going to do it for this week's episode of the MLB Pipeline Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss an episode. If you're enjoying the show or have any suggestions, leave us a rating and a review. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next week.